Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Welcome to episode 45 of the Chills at Will podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have with me Keegan Hamilton. And Keegan is a senior reporter, podcast host, and Emmy-nominated producer at Vice News, where he covers organized crime, prisons, and the drug trade. Keegan, how are you today? I really appreciate you joining me.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure. On this podcast, I've been able to have a plethora of diverse voices, children's book authors, and writers in Spanish and literary fiction and all the above. So it's really awesome to have you here. And, you know, I feel a little bit like, oh man, this is a true podcast host. I'm just a little dude with my mic and my headphones, you know, but pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for making the time.
No, thanks again for having me. I'm excited to talk about the work like this. I've seen, you know, some of what you do and you're coming at it from a different angle. So look forward to some of the questions.
Oh, that's awesome. I wonder, I mean, I know on a basic level, I guess, but I wonder what senior reporter means and kind of, you know, how you got that. Was there a day? Was there a ceremony? Was there a medal? You know, did you go from junior to senior? Like what does that mean to be a senior reporter?
Yeah. So basically senior reporter means that I work primarily on longer term projects, more investigative projects, like feature okay. stories, less of the day-to-day news, especially trying to avoid getting sucked into the news cycle, which over the last 4 years of Trump is a huge challenge.
Right.
Before this, I was an editor at Vice, who also I would kind of do some player coach, like reporting as well, feature stories. And then before that, I started kind of towards the bottom of the totem pole as a nights and weekends mm-hmm. editor, sort of overseeing coverage on the site. So just keeping at it, trying to keep putting out good work, and then have gotten to a point now where I can really sort of pick and choose which projects I'm working on and take my time with them.
Sure. Going back just a little bit, I wonder, like, I mean, have you always been the curious type, the investigative type? Were you the five-year-old, you know, doing detective stories and that kind of thing? Like, what kind of got you into journalism and investigative journalism?
Yeah, I mean, journalism has always been like a part of my life, I guess. Like, even when I was little, my dad was big into sports, and I was into sports when I was a kid too. So I'd read Sports Illustrated like cover to cover.
Oh yeah.
Every week. Especially with some of those big, you know, old names like Frank DeFore, Jack McCallum, and got really into like that nonfiction writing, I think partly through that. And then when I was in high school, my high school newspaper was kind of a big thing, and I was involved in that. Just found it, the journalism was fun. You get to go out and meet people and do things, see places. So stuck with it through college, and then worked in all weekly newspapers.
Okay.
After college, moved to New York, started working in more digital media, joined Vice, and the rest is history. That's the abridged version.
Wow, yeah. So two key questions, Trailblazers or Sonics?
Ooh, I was a Sonics guy growing up. I'm actually from about exactly halfway between Seattle and Portland.
Ah, okay.
But I tended to follow Seattle sports teams, but in the absence of the Sonics, I definitely right. support the Blazers right. now.
And if I say the name Buzz Beamer, does that mean anything to you?
Buzz Beamer, Federal Way?
Sports Illustrated, right. Sports Illustrated for kids, the blonde haired dude.
Oh no.
Okay.
See, I skipped, I didn't, Sports Illustrated for kids. My parents were like, here's Sports Illustrated for kids. And I'm like, where's the real Sports Illustrated?
Right. What are you doing? No, I hear you. When you talked about working at Alt Weeklies, like, I was reminded that I was listening to the podcast, the one about fentanyl that I've been listening to, you know, that we'll talk about in a minute. You were talking about, what was it? You were talking about, I think, how the main guy, Brandon, had been advertising in that type of magazine. Not exactly like that. There was something, like Topics, I think it was.
Yeah, like internet right? open forum, kind of like what would now would be like a next door kind of a thing.
Exactly. Right. So I guess my point is, you know, when I think of alt weeklies, I think of, you know, concerts, concert reviews, and you know, maybe restaurants are off the beaten path. And I think of like 20 pages of like weed advertisements.
Right? Well, back in the day, it was 20 pages of sex ads, like for a long time.
Correct. Right.
But at the same time, like alt weeklies were, and in some places still are, mm-hmm. One of the only sources of like long form narrative journalism yes. in communities.
Yes.
I was sort of the last among that last wave of reporters who came out and worked in local alt weeklies.
Sure.
And was part of that job was writing, you know, blog posts and doing some restaurant stuff and mm-hmm. more traditional alt weekly. But I also, part of my job as a staff writer was to write anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 word feature story once mm-hmm. a month. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, a narrative nonfiction kind of story. So really, from an early stage professionally, you had the opportunity to be working on longer, more in-depth, nuanced pieces.
Right.
In addition to doing, you know, all the other day-to-day
yeah.
stuff that comes with that.
I appreciate that. You kind of saw into my question. That was basically what I was going to ask about is like, you know, the links maybe between that and Vice. And like you talk about long form is, you know, way better than I do. It's not necessarily a dying form, right? It's just harder to find maybe or more nuanced. But yeah, I was just kind of wondering how writing for the All Weekly kind of made you a better writer, a different writer.
Yeah, I was really lucky to have a great editor, Tom Finkel, who was the editor of the paper I worked at, Riverfront Times in mm-hmm. St. Louis, who would just take the time to really like polish a piece and think about it and make sure that all the bases were covered. And I think that I've taken that with me ever since, and that approach to writing longer stories.
Sure.
I think it certainly helps that the sensibilities of Vice are in some ways similar to all weeklies. You know, counterculture-y, not
right.
somewhat outside the mainstream, but also I think in a more like not beat around the bush and just tell it like it is mm-hmm. in plain language,
yeah.
which can be a very powerful way to tell a story.
No doubt. I wonder, going back just a little bit, or not necessarily even going back, who are some of those giants for you? You talked about like McCallum and DeFord and some of those greats. Who are some of those, you know, not just in sports, but any genre really, who are some of the writers who have inspired you and continue to inspire you?
Yeah, I mean, I would call out some of the writers who got me interested in covering Mexico and organized crime and the drug trade. Mm-hmm. Charles Bowden is a fantastic author. He's got a book, Down by the River. He's also written a lot about the city of Juarez, Mexico.
Okay.
Fantastic writer. And I think his sort of outlook on this, that world of complicating good guys and bad guys, it's really easy to make cartel guys the caricature villain, mm-hmm. But there's nuance, I think, there, and it's important to talk to them and find out why they do what they do and how they came to be the people they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then just looking at it from like the history perspective, like there's some great journalism. The author Terrence Papa wrote a book called Drug Lord about old school narco named Pablo Acosta, who was worked in Ojinaga, Mexico, and it's just a fantastic accounting of that era in time and sort of a bygone era. And that his portrayal of that world, I think, got me really interested in like, wow, this is almost like in the realm of fiction and how crazy it is, but it's mm-hmm. true somehow. And I think that's still what in a way what draws me to this.
Acosta, and then what era would that have been, like the 60s and 70s or?
That's like the late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
He was a predecessor of Amado Carrillo and the Juarez sure. cartel.
I just had the pleasure to interview Luis Alberto Urrea, you know, who wrote The Devil's Highway,
mm-hmm.
which is,
yeah, I guess, that's cool.
Right.
I haven't read that book, but I've seen it. It's on my list.
Oh man. You talk about research and the way he uses a lot of second person you talk about trying to find nuance. He finds nuance with even the border agents, you know, who can often be vilified, and of course tells the stories of there were the 14 who died in the desert, who came from mostly Veracruz and in southern Mexico. And yeah, it's a great one. I know he writes a lot of fiction too, Luis does, but the nonfiction was incredible. Yeah. I appreciate that background there. There's some great ones. I was hoping you'd say the name, cause I don't know how the heck to pronounce it. I've read him before. His last name is Grillo or Grillo.
Oh, Yon Grillo.
Yon. Thank you.
Yeah. Yon.
I was like,
I know Yon. I met him a few times. He's a good guy, good reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Like in terms of contemporaries, guys still putting out work, always look forward to it, what he's right. got to say. I haven't had a chance to read. He's got a brand new book out about the gun trade in the U.S. and U.S. arms dealers and manufacturers supplying Latin America with the weapons that fuel the violence. So that's definitely a must read. And I have tremendous respect for Yon and the work that he does.
Oh, he's great. I just didn't know how to pronounce his name.
He's also one of the first, I think, international journalists to really shine a spotlight on Michoa Kahn. One of his books, El Narco, is a lot of the reporting is on the ground in Michoa Kahn.
I read that a long time ago. I think I need to go return to it. We could talk for hours about writers. I'll give you maybe one more before we talk about yours. Have you read Sam Quiñones?
Yeah, I also have had the pleasure of meeting Sam, and his book Dreamland is fantastic.
Of course.
If you listen to the Fentanyl podcast, Painkiller, that we made advice, that was definitely an influential work for us as we were thinking about putting that together, that series, and trying to add to the collective knowledge and capture the how complicated and vast that is in a way that gets people's attention. Sam did a fantastic job with that.
No doubt about it. Yeah, I was thinking, of course, with the Mexico connection, he actually, for whatever reason, wrote a lot about Michoa Kahn, but of course, Dreamland. And yeah, I do feel like your podcast and your articles about fentanyl, it is kind of like, Dreamland's not that old. It's only, maybe 2016, 17. But your work is kind of, like you said, adding on, like what's happened in the last couple of years with fentanyl, even. Great compliments to each other for sure, yeah. I wonder what it means for you to be a journalist versus a writer versus an author. You know, I think there's probably questions there about subjectivity, objectivity. What would you call yourself? Are you a journalist? Are you a writer? All the above?
I think that those go hand in hand. I don't think that those are mutually exclusive things. Certainly you can be a journalist without being a writer. There are camp cinematographers, photojournalists, lots of journalists don't have writing as a direct part of their job, but to do, to be, a senior reporter at Vice, writing is essential. And I also have the unique opportunity to sort of work across mediums. So I'm not just writing stories for the web. I'm also working on podcasts, which involve a different style of writing, and videos, which again, involve a different style of writing and different sort of language. So in that sense, like, what does it mean to be a writer 2021? I think being able to work across mediums is an important skill, and knowing sort of the language of each one. And it can be tough to shift gears going between them, just because the economy of language is so much different when you're working in video.
Sure. Do you feel like that's even changed in the last 2, 3, 4 years? Like as far as having to have a hand in different media?
Yeah, it's something that I've been sort of working towards for a long time, but it's hard to find a way to like make each story work on its own. Like the worst case scenario is you do a written story that's the exact version of the video that somebody reads one and then watches and they're like, why did I waste my time doing this, doing both?
True.
You want sort of works that complements each other.
Sure.
And it's tough. I still don't know that I have like the secret sauce to do that every time, or the perfect formula to make it work. But that's, I think now so many people consume news in different ways. It used to be everybody got the newspaper and read the news,
or
everybody watched the nightly news. But now people are getting their news from so many different places, primarily social media, and having ways to reach them through video, audio, and written story. I think hopefully we'll see more of that going forward.
Yeah. So kind of a two-part question about writing in the pandemic. I wonder how it's changed your own writing, not style, I guess, schedule, and also how it's affected, the availability of your interviewees, you know what I mean? Like,
I'll start with the second one. And that's actually like one of the upshots. I find that people have generally been more available during the pandemic. So everybody's home, more people are home. More people are getting interrupted by children or other things in the middle of their calls.
No doubt.
But I think I maybe it's just anecdotally, but I feel like it's been easier to connect with sources over the past year because people were locked down. In my own schedule, I've worked from home for a long time, worked remotely. I moved away from the main mothership of Vice in Brooklyn and live in California now.
Okay.
So I work remotely all the time. So it's, I've always had a sort of that routine of getting up and going to work without leaving the house.
Mm-hmm.
But it has gotten a little more intense during the pandemic for sure. And it's like the lines between like work time and non-work time are super blurry sometimes, especially when you're deep in a project working on it.
Are you, so, I mean, I guess you probably have enough deadlines that it's like that you don't have the trouble getting things done, or, you know, or you, do you have pretty open deadlines where you set yourself a schedule?
Well, I mean, it depends on the project and the story, right? Sometimes they got some more intermediate length or shorter term projects that are, you know, 2-3 weeks, a month in the making.
Mm-hmm.
But something like this, the Micho Kahn story, that's the latest thing where there's a video, a podcast, and a long form written piece. That was like 6-7 months in the making, from conceptualizing, pitching that story, going out in the field, and then coming back, doing all the post-production and writing. So yeah, you got to do it one day at a time, but it's a long time in the making.
Vice. I wonder about Vice. I wonder who is Vice's target audience, or who's your target audience? I guess maybe that's the same thing. Or do you have, or audience is plural possibly.
Yeah. I mean, I think Vice prides itself on being like a youth focused media company and reaching teenagers, 20 somethings, younger people in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that the audience is the internet, which is everyone. Like when I put out a story or a project like this, the goal is not just to reach exclusively young people. I certainly want them to read. And I think it's important that we do it and do news in a way that young people find it interesting and want to consume it.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm looking for the people in Micho Kahn to read and write the story. It's part of the reason we translated this piece into Spanish recently, put it on the internet, is just to try to reach an audience like that. So the if you ask our PR people, they would say we're the world's largest youth-focused media company.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to look at it as you know, tell a good story and everyone will be interested.
You talk about the mixed media, the multimedia, podcasting in particular, and audio. I mean, you have a good voice for it, obviously. Is that something you've had to work at? Is, you know, is that something that you always did? Is, you know, you were in drama class as a kid, or, you know, whatever, you read at church or something. Is that something you've had to work on, or is that something that kind of came naturally?
Yeah, believe it or not, my father was in radio. He was a local radio DJ.
Okay.
So I was growing up, I would always like be around the radio stations, around it. Never thought that I personally would do it. Podcasting sort of came about in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, right? As a really like phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When I started working on that at first, I had to try to get rid of vocal tics, had some coaching about how to best be enunciate and be that voice, I guess. And now I feel like I've maybe gotten the hang of it a little bit better. Maybe my producers would disagree sometimes, but figuring out in how to sound natural is the hardest thing. Like how to write a line in the way that you would speak it naturally is a huge challenge.
I just kind of wonder, I mean, you probably can't enumerate it or whatever, but I always wonder, like, you know, it sounds very professional when the finish is done. I mean, are there times where you're like, ah, shoot, you know, like totally mess it up and start it again? Is that something that happens?
Oh yeah. So many times, especially you ask about how the pandemic has changed work. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we made the El Chapo podcast, that was recorded in pretty defined chunks of time in Vice's studios in Brooklyn. But when we did this podcast, we couldn't go to a professional studio because they were all closed because of the pandemic. So we had to build like a makeshift studio in my office closet, which is still right next to me here. Had the both benefit and curse of being available to do pickups all the time and like say the line a little bit differently and send it to the editor to cut it in. So that, I think, allowed us to do a lot more fine tuning and polishing in a way that we didn't do in previous podcast series.
Yeah. So I've heard people say, more professional than myself, that the closet is really good for like minimizing background noise or not background.
Yeah. It's to like deaden the sound.
Deaden the sound.
So I have like acoustic foam on the walls and then like a microphone set up with the pop filter and all that. It's a whole thing that I personally would not have had the knowledge to do on my own, but working with the awesome team that I have, I have that set up, and it's been, now as I take it for granted, I can just step into the closet and like track some VO and step out. It's kind of weird.
So if I got the chronology correct here, it would have been the El Chapo podcast along with the accompanying writing, then Fentanyl, then Michoacan.
That's it, yeah.
Is that right? You know, I'm sitting here with some of my favorite books of all time here. I got The Sicilian by Mario Puzo. I got The Godfather, and being Italian, you know, whatever. I've always had that interest, like so many people do, in organized crime. I don't think I've ever romanticized it. I hope not. I wonder if with someone like El Chapo, you know, I'm a high school teacher, and on my playlist in class, I just play the instrumental, but I play El Chapo by The Game because it's got an incredible beat, gets the class, you know, hyped up or whatever, right? I wonder just, you know, there's shirts with El Chapo on them, you know, blah, blah, blah. I wonder just what you've kind of seen with the romanticizing of not just him, but other, you know, the John Gottis, the Capones of the world.
Yeah, I mean, America has long had a fascination with the lovable outlaw, like the roguish, charming rogue. Mm-hmm. Al Capone, as you said, like there's that sort of, even farther back into the Old West with right. Billy the Kid and that sort of, mm-hmm. mythologized character. And the same is true in Mexico with Pancho Villa, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you can draw a pretty straight line from the way that those figures were romanticized and mythologized to present day with somebody like El Chapo and mm-hmm. or mob figures like Gotti, the example mm-hmm. you gave. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's fictionalized media plays a huge role in that. Like The Godfather, I think, is single-handedly propelled Italian organized crime in the United States into something that was an object of fascination and intrigue mm-hmm. and something to be like respected and thought about intellectually. Mm-hmm. And with the drug trade, you see it more with like Scarface, where that is sort of like the defining image. And then at the same time as Scarface, you have Pablo Escobar and those mm-hmm. sort of real life and fictional figures at the same time.
Sure.
I think that those tropes that you get from Scarface really still active today in the drug world. I mean, you go, I've personally been to the homes of like younger gang members and drug dealers who still have Scarface pictures hanging on the walls because that's like an enduring image that resonates with people. Chapo, I think, can, especially for Mexicans who are, especially for Sinaloan Mexicans, I should mm-hmm. be very specific here. There's a definite part of that state, that part of Mexico, who looks at him as the Robin Hood figure, this mythologized,
right,
the almost Jesus Malverde bandit. Mm. But then, I've traveled enough in Mexico and met enough Mexican people who say that he's a criminal and he should be treated like a criminal. He's not to be revered. Right. So I think it is important to understand that he's not necessarily the romantic figure that he is. And if you follow the trial or any of the crimes that he's accused of, you know that he's done horrible, horrible things.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that background there. And you're talking about, you know, some will romanticize and some won't, a lot won't. I wonder, maybe this is too broad of a question, but I wonder what some of the misconceptions are that you've seen with like Americans about the drug trade. So I don't know if that's too big of a question.
Yeah, there's a lot, right?
How much time do we got, right?
Yeah. I think the biggest one is, and we sort of hit on this at the very beginning of the interview that you're asking, is that it's so easy to caricaturize cartel people as evil, like inherently evil, like almost like one-dimensional evil, like Nazi evil, right? Mm-hmm. But if you go and talk to these folks, there's some of that. Some of them's awful people, right? They do awful things, but you got to understand that the poverty is so extreme. They're drawn into this world. You understand where, why, and how they come about. And I think that's lost for the average American, is just think that like, oh, these are bad guys. I don't know how they came about or why, but they're bad and we should arrest them or kill them. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that as long as there's lack of understanding, it's going to perpetuate the same cycle and the same failed solutions.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. I wonder, like, I would assume that comes into play when you're presenting some of these stories about trying to find that balance between, we don't want to romanticize, but you said the how and the why is crucial, right? Mm-hmm. Not just that these people just became, they're just the way they are because like, why, how?
Yeah. And it can also be tough to push back in interviews with these people, right? Like if you listen to the podcast that we did about Michoacan or watch the video that we produced about it, mm-hmm. interviewing the commander from the Jalisco cartel, in that interview, there's armed bodyguards all around. The guy himself has a gun on his lap as we're talking to him. That's not really a like a a space for an adversarial right. interview where I'm like grilling the guy.
Right.
But you know, I can take the opportunity to say like, look, we've talked to people. People have said this about you. Here's what we heard. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that? As sort of like get a response to the allegations. And that's how I handle that situation. I think mm-hmm. is the best that can be done under the circumstances and trying to walk away from the interview.
You know, the writer that you are, you obviously want to get the correct words and you can do more of the editing on the written part. I wonder about the translation. I wonder about, you know, things being lost in translation. I wonder, being American, I wonder about how is your Spanish top notch?
Así.
Like, I wonder how you go about being so careful when, you know, you talked about being in some incredibly tense circumstances, to say the least, about how you kind of balance, like, saying the right thing to the right people in Espanol. Like,
con ayuda. Yeah, my Spanish is not good enough to be confident enough to say the right thing exactly in Spanish. So that's working with a translator, especially a native Mexican translator, is really important to make sure that the question is phrased in a way that is accurate and delicate, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, like, my Spanish is good enough that I can understand what's being said back to me, usually more or less, like 90%, or and that I feel like can sometimes give an extra bit of time to think about what the next question is going to be and how it's phrased as the English is then being relayed.
Right.
So I wish that I spoke perfectly fluent Spanish and could do the interviews all in Spanish, but under the circumstances, I think it works really well. And I was lucky to work with my producer Miguel Fernandez, who is from a Mexico native who did some amazing under pressure field translating.
I bet. What was your pitch to Vice about this, about the Michoacan piece? Or is that, you know, in a couple sentences, maybe, like, what was the gist of it?
Yeah, that's a good question that people don't often ask about stories. And this one, it was straightforward. It was, you know, we're coming up on 15 years of the Guerra contra el Narco in Mexico, mm-hmm. the declaration of the war on drugs by Felipe Calderon, mm-hmm. Which started in Michoacan, is the first state where the soldiers were deployed. And now 15 years later, it's arguably gotten worse and the soldiers are still there, mm-hmm. you know, chronicling the history of this mess. And also then, okay, well, is there an exit strategy? How do we end right. this war? Is that even possible?
Right. I wonder what the gist of what you got down there was about the drug war. You know, people say, don't call it a war. Don't act like it's a war. What is kind of the prevailing or some of the prevailing opinions in Mexico about the U.S. drug war? I'm talking more on, well, I guess both sides, right? The U.S. has declared war on drugs for a long time. And then, like you talked about 2006 with Mexico. What are some of the prevailing opinions there?
Yeah, I mean, that's you asked earlier about misconceptions. I think a lot of Americans, when you think about the war on drugs or the drug war, it's an abstract, like, policy war with, like, mm-hmm. tough on crime law. Mm-hmm. You go to Mexico, it is a war. Like, there are tanks, there are soldiers, there is combat. It is a war zone. And most Mexicans I know are tired of it. They wish that there was a solution to it. And I think that a lot of that fatigue is sort of the cynicism that the people fighting the war are not really fighting to end it. They're fighting to keep it going because people make money off of that. So I think what my takeaway from the war there is that people are looking to end the war, but there's no easy end in sight. And I know that the government there has taken a lot of heat for, including from my own article about their policies of not de-escalating AMLO promised he would in his political campaign.
Sure.
But then you see that this is a war and there are paramilitary groups, and to get peace there, it's not as easy as just saying, like, stop fighting and we're going to de-escalate. It's mm-hmm. it's going to be a years long process of winding down this conflict and needing some sort of, like, truth and reconciliation commissions to really get beyond where they are today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to say that there's, like, oh, that there's a happy ending to your articles and your podcast and it's just around the corner is, you know, being naive or whatever, but there was Chopo is his name, right?
Chopo, yeah.
Chopo is the one you quote, and, you know, again, not to be cheesy about it, but does show a little bit of hope. He's the one working right outside with, like, a turtle sanctuary, right? And he was talking about like, hey, the help could be here. Sounds like that AMLO, like you say, could be sending the help, but he's not. But as far as the hope goes, it was kind of a nice little way to end. Like this is what it could be like.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you made it clear in the article, you know, like there's still danger right there and right there.
That's they're part of that auto defensa tradition in Michoacán, mm-hmm. where it's these civilian led militias that are formed to sort of be community police, do the job that the actual local police can't or won't do. It's hard to say that we didn't have enough time to really go into the full story, but there is sort of parts of that Chopo story are only really touched on in what I wrote. And they've been through the ringer in that with their auto defensa and having the previous boss, they successfully kicked out the cartel only to see the guy who led that uprising then extort people. So there's complicated history there. And now I think a lot of the conflict in Michoacán, especially in that part of Michoacán, is so hyper local and not exactly about drugs. Like that's another misconception. Everybody thinks this is exclusively about trafficking drugs. In Michoacán, especially in this part of Michoacán, the Tierra Caliente and the coast, it's a classic just like control of local turf and sort of local criminal groups fighting against each other. So even if you were to do some crazy innovative drug policy solution to try to end the drug war, there's going to be lingering bad blood and conflict that continues to fester for a long time.
I think one of the interesting parts of your projects is the indigenous communities, right? A lot of that had to do with the auto defensas and Cheran, and there was another town that was able to be true auto defensas. I wonder how the treatment of the indigenous has come into play, how you saw that.
Yeah, I mean, being indigenous is a big part of why they've been able to do what they've done, because this community is so insular and so organized and has had its own really like social order and system of government for so long that when it comes time to like, actually, hey, we have a problem in our community, let's everyone talk about the best way to do it. Everyone knows each other. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out a solution together. And it works security wise because these areas are so small that when you put checkpoints on your roads, if somebody shows up, everybody knows who they are, or like you gotta like, oh, who's your family? Who do you know? And if you don't have a reason to be there and know someone, they're not going to let you in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hyper localness of their situation, I think, allows them to have the success that they've had, both in a security perspective and also from their own political independence and self-sufficiency.
You know, to kind of bring the three projects together with El Chapo, then the second one was fentanyl. And so I wonder, you know, very interesting, very scary about how explosive that drug is. You know, you talk about like a toothpick is enough to kill, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. But I just wonder kind of generally with that, of course, the fentanyl usage is not in Mexico. It's here for the most part, right? It's not in 100%. China, right? So yeah. I guess just kind of more of a broader question about what's the United States responsibility where, you know, let's talk about it as a mutual thing where there are drugs coming from parts of the world, but we in the United States are using them to excess. Go ahead.
That's a super important part of this. And talking about, you know, the views I encounter of, you know, everyday Mexicans and reporting in Mexico is the United States bears equal, if not all, responsibility for creating the market for these drugs. And I think it's in the coming years, it's going to be super important for America to continue to rethink drug laws. We've already seen change start to happen in the last few years. Marijuana legalization, I think, has been a great test case to see that a drug that was illegal for a long time can be made legal and the sky doesn't fall. And not only does the sky not fall, you make a bunch of tax money off it that can go to schools and other things that people like. So I don't think that approach is going to be viable with a drug like fentanyl anytime soon, like illicit fentanyl. But I do think that it matters how the U.S. treats drug offenders and treats just drug addiction in general. We sort of acknowledged for a long time that this is a problem that needs to be handled differently and have not handled it differently. So I'm really looking at the Biden administration to try to think outside the box and actually, you know, put their money where their mouth is and more harm reduction and more evidence-based treatment of drug addiction being made available through federal dollars.
Very interesting. Yeah, it seems like we've been doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Yeah. Three really, really important and very interesting projects. I mean, thank you for those. I'm just finishing up the Fentanyl series. And it, like I said, it's scary, so interesting, so much background. You do a great job linking all kinds of things together. And then to have listened to the, you know, and read El Chapo and, you know, the drug wars in Michoacan, it comes together. So what's next? What kind of future projects are you working on? If you don't mind sharing, you don't have to.
I'm actually looking around at what's next. I'm obviously still interested in Mexico and the drug war there.
Okay.
That's a problem that only looks like it's going to continue to get worse. The Jalisco New Generation cartel that was a big part of this Michoacan story isn't going away and will continue to be fueling the violence in Mexico. I reported a lot on Chapo, but now it's El Chapo's sons are the ones who have inherited his faction of the Sinaloa cartel and are still active in Sinaloa. So that's obviously of interest to me. In the Biden era, as we were just sort of ending there, thinking about more solutions-based coverage of these stories, a lot of the journalism about, especially the opioid crisis and addiction, has been, hey, look how bad this problem is, and not like, here's how we solve this problem as a country and move forward. Mm-hmm. And so some of the, like the end of the Fentanyl series tries to go that direction a little bit.
Okay.
So previous stories I've written have done that, but I think that's another important part that I'm thinking of is, okay, we know it's bad. What can we do about it?
Well, I got maybe a suggestion. It could be a short kind of more fun one is I saw on Twitter today, AMLO showing off his baseball swing. Did you see that?
AMLO's been known as the baseball guy. Yeah, he's.
I missed that, obviously. Man, he got a good swing.
Yeah, for an old guy, he's looking pretty nimble. He was, yeah. I think last year he was like fielding grounders or something, and he looked really nimble.
So I'm behind the times on that. Maybe you could do like a deep dive into, you know, the history of his baseball skills and how he keeps it going. Obviously, Mexico's got the same COVID type of thing going on, and things are horrible there. So wish he were doing more, like, you know, for COVID, but. Anyways, thank you so much. Again, you know, it's great that you talk about the long form journalism and you get nuance, you get subtlety, you get objectivity, and you get some really interesting stories. And so really appreciate your writing and your reporting. And man, thanks so much for making time for me today. Really appreciate it.
Nate, thanks for the in-depth conversation and thinking critically about this kind of stuff.
I'll make sure that I you know, get the links out there for all of your work. And, you know, just want to wish you great luck with your continued work.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me.
Thanks so much. Thank you for listening to episode 45 with Keegan Hamilton. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, that's new, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation. And I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look in an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will podcast is Wind Down instrumental version. And the other great song played on the episode is Hoops instrumental by Matt Whitehour. And both songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers and creatives with mad skill like Keegan Hamilton, whose word gives you chills at will.